Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
New Scientist double issue of the 22nd and 29th of December 2018. Just some articles, random articles in this fairly thick magazine which I'm reading through. And it's a Rogue Traders. We thought economics was a uniquely human pursuit, but even simple organisms are at it, says Daniel Cousins. So this is me just trying to get into reading, making it a bit interesting, and get the stamina up. Quote, there is a propensity to truck, barter, and exchange one thing for another. It is common to all men, and to be found in no other race of animals, wrote Adam Smith in The Wealth of Nations. That was back in 1776, but the idea that humans are the only species always capable of economic behaviour persisted for a long time. Intuitively, it makes sense. Responding to shifts in supply and demand, for instance, must be the perverse preserve of species with brains hefty enough to think through decisions rationally, or so we thought. As we get to know Earth's myriad of other species better, it's becoming apparent that many animals and organisms make trades, and that some are surprisingly savvy wheelers, dealers, capable of manipulating the market in their own selfish interest. From frisky baboons to fish offering spa treatments on a reef, pretty much everywhere we look in nature we find evidence of surprisingly sophisticated economic decision makings. Even fungi are at it, and according to the latest studies, these brainless soil dwellers give the impression of being more rational than us. Such revelations are handing us a fresh understanding of the origins of cooperation. They also chip away at the idea that sophisticated behaviour requires a big brain. They might even teach us a thing or two about ourselves, says Toby Kears of the evolutionary biologist at Free University Amsterdam. Quote, we are the basic strategy organisms that evolved to cope with relentless variations in resource availability. It's naive to think an NBA will teach us everything we need to know. Anyone who has watched a wildlife documentary knows that cooperation is common in nature. Monkeys groom one another, hyenas hunt in packs. And it's not just animals of the same species that work together. Until recently, all this collaboration didn't make much sense in the context of Darwin's theory of evolution by natural selection. If ruthless self-interest is the rule, why cooperate? When Ronald No began watching baboons in Kenya in the early 1980s, there were two answers to the question, both with flaws. The first was kin selection, the idea that an animal sometimes stands a better chance of passing on its DNA, not by finding a mate itself, but by helping a close relative to reproduce. But kin selection can't easily account for cases in which unrelated species help each other. The other argument was reciprocal altruism, which says that animals that help others do so because they know they will get something in return. Game theory was invoked to explain how an altruistic animal could guarantee reciprocity with evolutionary theorists using a two-player game called The Prisoner's Dilemma to figure out how it worked in nature. But there was a problem. Quote, they were building cards of houses of one model on top of another and never bothering about empirical evidence, says Noah, who recently retired from the University of Strasbourg in France. Out in the field, he quickly noticed their error. When two low-ranking baboons teamed up to challenge a dominant male so that one of them could mate with a female, they didn't always stick with the same collaborator after dethroning, as theorists had assumed in their models. Quite the opposite. These males switched partners and played their friends off against each other. To make sure they got more mating time than other collaborators, says Noel, big baboons like Situ, the first challenger that Noah studied, knew that a collaborator... would accept less rather than risk losing his support. In a nutshell, this showed that the essence of cooperative relationships was partner choice, says Noel. In a baboon society, at least, when it comes to exchange of services in pursuit of mating, the fact that individuals like Soot could shop around for the best deal from prospective collaborators makes all the difference. Partner choice is what drives the market, says Noel. In 1994, together with Peter Hammerstein, Now, at Humboldt University in Berlin, Noel set out his theory of biological markets, inspired by his observation of baboons. Then he tried applying it to all manners of other species to see if it could explain their cooperative behaviour. It worked. And although it didn't catch on immediately, the new theory captured the imagination of several young biologists, including Rodolon Bachet, then one of Noel's PhD students. Fishy business. At that point, it had only been applied to animal behaviour already recorded in literature. Quote, I thought it would be nice to go out and explicitly test it in the wild in a new system, says Bachary, who is now at the University of Neuchâtel in Switzerland. Bachary settled on a diminutive reef fish called the cleanser wrasse, which scrapes a living, nibbling, tiny parasites from between the scales of other fish that pass its cleaning station. He picked out the wrasse because, even though its behaviour is a nice example of mutualism, in that cleaners get food and the client gets cleaned, there is a conflict of interest. Cleaners like to take nips of their client's protective mucus layers more than they do parasites. So they are liable to cheat. This means, to get a good service, clients have to get cleaners to go against their preference, and cleaners have to choose when to cheat, says Bachary. Having learned to scuba dive, Bachary spent countless hours observing cleaner wrasse in the Red Sea. He saw they had two types of clients. There are visitors, such as parrotfish, which can grow to 40 centimetres long and can travel easily between several cleaning stations. There are residents, like the smaller Menros wrasse, that tends to stick to one. Bachary figured that visitors have a strategic advantage because they could chop around. Sure enough, in 2002, he showed that visitors almost always got better service. They were seen more quickly and treated more gently, with the cleaners less likely to sneak a bite for themselves than the residents. Clients can switch partners to force a good service, he says. That's interesting about switching partners. The cleaning adjustments to the coral reef free market don't end there. Bachary has found that cleaners are less likely to cheat when another fish is watching, and they never do when the client is... A predator. Most recently, observing around Lizard Island in Australia, Bachary and his colleagues noticed that cleaners had stopped giving visitors priority access. The reason, he suggests, is that several cyclones and an El Nino climate oscillation killed off 80% of its cleaner wrasse. It suddenly became a restricted market, and the cleaners know it. There's nothing to stop them from making visitors wait. I was optimistic that the market paradigm would work in this system, says Bachary, but the sophistication continues to surprise me. The fish are constantly adjusting to market conditions and updating their strategies accordingly. They can do so with tiny brains challenges the idea that only creatures with weighty lumps of grey matter are capable of complex behaviours such as responding to shifts in supply and demand. It's interesting, the supply and demand aspect. One of the lessons here is that we are probably going to have to rethink that, says Bachary. We now see, at least within ecologically relevant contexts, pretty much any animal can show high levels of sophistication in terms of their behaviour. Indeed, over the past few years, biologists have shown that scores of animals are capable of responding to market forces, including chimpanzees, marquees, mongooses, ants, wasps, and small fish called chicholids. I know those from, I think they're in some sort of Lake Victoria. In one of the most recently unearthed examples of biological market, the traders don't have brains at all. Kears studied the underground marketplace in which microchisel fungi trade phosphorus or carbon with their roots of plants. This is a perfect environment for market dynamics to emerge, she says, because a single fungal network can be connected to many plants and switch between trading partners rapidly. The plant in turn can choose from many competing fungi strain. Sure enough, as Kears tracked exchanges in these underground networks, she discovered all kinds of economic shenanigans. She and her colleagues employed a series of choice experiments in which fungus is connected to several hosts at once. This showed that fungus will avoid trading with plants growing in the shade, for example. Funky are avoiding bad trading partners, she says, but that is far from the funky's most cunning ploy. Care has also caught them hoarding resources, storing their phosphorus in a form that is inaccessible to plants. In doing so, they can artificially inflate the price, getting more carbon returned from plants. She says it's a brilliant strategy. But what's really going on here? Is the fungus acting rationally in a way that Adam Smith would never have thought possible? That depends on how you define rational. We know that trading strategies can be determined by evolved mechanisms, not just by cognitive means. These are, quote, less flexible, but have been tested and fine-tuned by natural selection, says Noel. This means that when they are used in situations in which the species at hand finds themselves frequently, these strategies can yield better results. Even the simplest organisms operating in markets can give the impression of rational self-interest. Still, animals, plants, and fungi can't match the complexities of humans' economics behaviour. As far as we know, they don't employ a common currency, for instance. But that can make them all the more revealing. While primates are undoubtedly more interesting to watch, fungal plant systems can be precisely manipulated and trades can be tracked, says Keyes. We can watch trade strategies evolve, study tipping points for when and how the trade relationships break down. Keyes' work has recently attracted the attention of Albert Minkevild, a finance researcher at the Free University of Amsterdam. Minkevild is interested in how best to police and regulate high-frequency trading, in which algorithms compete against each other to make profitable trades on split-second timescales. Since both fungi and algorithms are competing with trading partners in similarly uncomplicated ways, it might be possible to use a fungal system to better understand how so-called flash trading markets will respond to certain strategies. For Keyes, the most interesting thing about studying mycorrhizal fungi is that it reveals trading strategies uncontaminated by cognition. These are pure economic decisions, nothing to do with resentment or hope or anything like that, she says. Here we can witness economic behaviour in its most pure and ancestral form. This is the second article, and it's quite clear that New Scientist has been hoarding these articles during the year. So they're not fit for their general magazine, but they're general interest articles, which fit nicely in the Christmas edition. This article is entitled Strange Snow. Ice has been made incredible, ice has many incredible guises and some can make it us feel quite magical, says Padma Nagapam. I'll see if I can get the pronunciation and mistakes down here. Sun dogs. These are crystallized bright spots of reflection due to crystals out of the sun. I think that's, I've just got to remember who, Bruno, there was various people who have studied sun dogs. Okay. You aren't seeing triple. Sun dogs, brightly coloured blobs of light, sometimes visible on either side of the sun, pictured below, are really mirror images of our star. They appear when it's cold enough for tiny ice crystals to be present in the atmosphere. The illusion is the result of sunlight bending or refracting through these floating crystals, which act as prisms. Consequently, sun dogs are rainbow-hued. The inner edges closer to the sun are tinged with shades of red, while the outer edges are blue. They belong to a group of optical phenomena called halos, which all involve sunlight interacting with ice crystals. Sun dogs are officially called parahelia. There are more common name derives from their appearing to follow the sun, like a dog that follows its master. The best time to try to spot them is when the sun is close to the horizon around sunrise or sunset. Frost flowers. A truly rare sight, these beautiful but short-lived ice sculptures form when sap inside the plant freezes. This can happen when the end temperature is freezing but the ground is not yet frozen. The sap inside long-stem plants expands in the cold, creating cracks in the stems. Now, water can ooze out and freeze, forming intricate, fragile ribbons or flower-like structures. Snow rollers. I don't think that's a really form of snow, I suppose. Snow rollers. as big as an oil barrel or as small as fragile as a stick of candy floss. Snow rollers, pictured right, form on windy hillsides when strong gusts blow moist snow along the ground. Quote, you get a chunk of snow that peels and bends and curls itself, says Jeffrey Deems at the National Snow and Ice Data Center in Boulder, Colorado. The result is a hollow, cylindrical roll of the stuff with a thin, weak inner layer. Depending on its size and shape, it might be called a snow roller or a snow bale or a snow donut. Snow rollers are rare, but sightings every few years only when conditions are just right. First, there needs to be a thin surface layer of wet snow. Underneath that has to be a layer of powdery snow or ice so the surface layer can flip up and roll as the wind blows without sticking to it. The wind must have a Goldilocks element to it, too. It must be strong enough to lift the snow roll, but does not so strong as to blow the roller away. Oh, there you can see some snow rolls. Hoar frost. The name derives from the Old English word har, meaning white or grey with age. Because hoarfrost deposits its long spiky crystals into objects like trees and fences, transforming their appearance. Like regular frost, this variety pictured above forms when water vapor turns to ice on a surface that is below freezing. If there is a high enough deposition rate, which depends on moisture and temperature gradients from the atmosphere to the surface, says Deems, the crystals can grow into a feathery kind typical of hoarfrost. Because the interlocking patterns of crystals grow in size and complexity, the nickname of the phenomena is frost on steroids. When it forms on snow, the result can be a giant field of feathery crystals with a surface hoar. Grupel. Grupel, pictured above, is perhaps the ultimate whimsical weather phenomenon, a case of an unorthodox snow that forms inside a cloud. More precisely, involves supercooled water droplets condensing on the top of falling snowflakes. The droplets freeze, and as they do so, they change the shape of the snowflake, turning them into small, squishy balls or pellets. When you get a snowflake forming in a cloud, the liquid water inside the cloud freezes in the snowflake as rime, and then hits the ground as Grupel, says Deems. I sort of remember Grupel. I remember that. It's very interesting seeing snowflakes grow. My theory, they don't grow bit by bit, but they have to, by vibration, minimize the energy as they go along. Rime. I used to think snowflakes grew by molecular deposition, but there's actually liquid deposition. The liquid flows symmetrically around for the flake. Rime. A thick layer of styrofoam-like ice sometimes is seen on top of parked cars, trees, and telephone poles. It's called rime, pictured above right. It tends to form straight on to surfaces of cold, foggy environments with lots of water vapor in the air. For this to succeed, the tiny droplets or cloud of fog must be supercooled. In other words, cool below freezing point, but able to stay liquid. Often thanks to impurities in the water, when these droplets then come into contact with any cold object, like a parked car, they immediately freeze on it. Lasting fog can lead to huge build-ups of rime. When it forms from supercooled water vapor turning directly to ice, it cools like spiky, sparkly crystals, says Deem. But if the process involves tiny droplets freezing, the rime is chunkier consistency because the resulting ice crystals are randomly oriented. It's a bit interesting because that's sort of how my heart valve is generated. It's a sort of a carbon snow which grows down. Okay, this next article called Rayburn is called Early 20th Century Attempts to Build a Death Ray Were a Dark Farce, writes Jeff Hecht. The enemy wasted no time firing up the death rays once they arrived in Woking, W-O-K-I-N-G, generated in an almost perfectly insulating chamber
and focus by a parabolic mirror of unknown composition. These scorchingly intense beams of heat energy rained untold destruction on the dormitory town of Surrey, just to the southwest of London. Quote, whatever is combustible flashes into flame at its touch. Lead runs like water. It softens iron, cracks and melts glass, and when it falls upon water, incontinently, that explodes into steam. The Observer wrote, this isn't reality unless something untoward is currently stirring. I'm sorry, this is really hard for me to read. The suburbs. But a scene from H.G. Wells' 1898 classic about Martian invasion, The War of the Worlds. Where Wells blazed a trail, many others have followed. From the ray guns wielded by Buck Rogers and the Flash Gordon to Star Trek phases and planet-destroying Death Star of Star Wars, weapons formed of fearsomely energetic beams have become sci-fi staple. What has been largely forgotten are the efforts over the decades in the early 20th century to make real-world death rays. It's a story of egos, charlatanry, deception, and dark comedy. As so often, Wells was ahead of his time, but also very much of his time. At the turn of the 20th century, new types of radiation were in the news. Heinrich Hertz proved the existence of radio waves in 1887. Wilhelm Röntgen produced X-rays in 1895, and alpha, beta, gamma rays soon followed. The ensuing years, an arms race developed as Europe drifted towards war, as the new technology loomed largely in many a mind. In 1913, the 32-year-old Italian inventor Giulio Ulvi claimed a new form of invisible infrared radiation he called F-rays would deliver enough energy through the air to detonate gunpowder 16 kilometres away. Armed with F-ray generators, he said, an army could discharge enemy bullets and artillery, detonate their munitions and blow up attacking ships from the shore. French military officials pricked up their ears but lost interest when Ulvi wouldn't let them control a test. Italian Navy meanwhile gave him money to build a lab. By 1914, Ulvi had claimed his F-ray had blown up mines and torpedoes in an Italian river, and a public test was scheduled. By now, though, things were highly charged in another sense. Ulvi had fallen in love with Maria Luisi Fornari, the daughter of an Italian admiral supervising experiments. The admiral insisted Ulvi finish his work before marriage, but the couple instead eloped amid the accusation that Ulvi had rigged his test by sparking the explosive with sodium that exploded when the water leaked in. Certainly it seems he only used his own explosives. His tests never worked, only ever worked underwater. Others were also lured by the ray technologies. On the other side of the Atlantic, they fascinated Nikola Tesla, the electrical engineer and polymath. The same year War of the Worlds was published, he had used radio waves to control a model boat. And in 1899, he showed he could send electricity short distances through the air. He soon claimed that he could beam electric power across the Atlantic. And in 1901, talked financier J.P. Morgan into giving him $150,000, more than $54 million today, to build a 57-meter-high Watercliff Tower in Long Island near New York to show it off. Now, this is actually interesting because that had to be destroyed, I think, in World War II, because it was used by German subs to locate, navigate off. Electric air. The physics was dodgy, and Tesla burned through the money before he could test the idea. In March 1916, with the US yet to enter the First World War, Tesla told the Electrical Experimenter magazine that he would detonate explosives hundreds of kilometres away with his wireless power. The magazine cover headlined, The Tesla Destroyer, shows a heat engineering tower on the shoreline and ships exploding at sea. It may have been a last gasp attempt to drum up more publicity and cash. In 1917, Tesla's creditor had their wonderful tower torn down for scrap. Oh, that's why, the real reason.
It was left to a largely British inventor and entrepreneur called Harry Grindell Matthews to continue flying the flag for death rays. He was a veteran of the Boer War in South Africa, in which 1901 had seen the British forces using Guillermo Marconi's newly minted radio telegraphs to communicate. In 1909, when 29 and living with his mother in Rudgeway, just north of Bristol, Grindell Matthews patented a wireless radio telephone system. He raised money to found Grindell Matthews Wireless Telephone Company, which in 1911 was offering aerophones with an 8-kilometre range for under £20, equivalent to around $2,000 today. The company failed in 1914, and a series of largely unsuccessful military and business ventures followed. But the advent of aerial and rocket warfare during the First World War saw a further uptick of interest in death rays as a means of countering enemy attacks from the sky. Under the attack of these electric waves, the airplane will fall as though struck by a thunderbolt. The tank will burst in flames and the dreadnought will blow up. Poisonous gas will be dispersed, wrote French Army Chief General Marie Eugène Debney in the New York Times in September 1921. When several French planes flying over Bavaria were forced to make an emergency landing in 1923, French officials suspected Germany had a wireless electric ray weapon, spurring a desire to have one of their own. Sensing the opportunity, by 1924, Grindell Matthews was devoting to a London meeting of the Foreign Press Association details of an invention that would, he said, make war impossible. His death ray would ionize air by illuminating it with ultraviolet light so it would conduct electricity. Press reports claimed it would stop planes, ignite their wings, destroy one in 5 seconds, or even wipe out whole armies. Upon hearing that the ray had killed a mouse from 20 meters away, on the 24th of April 1924, Winston Churchill, at the time out of the office, Parliament and Party, but soon become Chancellor of the Exchequer, wrote to a friend, physicist Frederick Alexander Lindemann, that it's worth investigating, but it may be a hoax. The idea wasn't daft. Ultraviolet light can ionize atoms of the air, and ions do conduct electricity, but it meant concentrating the ultraviolet light along a whole path to the target and cranking the voltage to a level enough to fire a deadly bolt of electricity. On the 26th of May, following a question in Parliament, a demonstration was set up in Grindell Matthews' London lab. The best the death ray could do was stall a motorcycle engine about 14 metres away. The Air Ministry was unimpressed, but offered to pay Grindell Matthews £1,000 if he could stop a large engine in a government-run test. Himself unimpressed by the level of his largesse, Grindell Matthews hot-footed to Croydon Aerodrome, south of London, to head for Paris. In a veritable French farce, his British investors set out in pursuit, brandishing an injunction and barring him from leaving the country. He had taken off before he got to Croydon. They got to Croydon. In France, Grindell Matthews made an 8-minute silent film promoting his death ray that was shown in London and New York movie theatres. To a jolly piano accompaniment, the inventor shows how his wirelessly lights a bulb and detonates a small pile of gunpowder. Words flash on the screen claiming that within 15 years the machine gun will only be found in museums and that the Grindell Matthews death ray in the future may control the destiny of the world. Doubts soon surfaced, however. Physicist Ernest Rutherford, who had discovered alphas, beta and gamma rays, warned government officials to avoid Grindell Matthews. A former collaborator, Irish physicist E. Fournier d'Albe, called the death ray a myth that the British public wanted to believe because the scars left by the First World War. With no credible results to show, death rays faded from the news. Grindell Matthews spent a few years in the US promoting other unsuccessful inventions. By 1932, was back in the UK, owing creditors more than £11,000. He told a bankruptcy court that he had earned only £3,300 since 1924. Prosperity finally arrived in 1938, 3 years before his death, when he married a wannabe opera singer, Gunnar Wallisca, whose previous four husbands included a couple of millionaires. Trump cards.
In the 1930s, with another war looming, the British Air Ministry decided the best defence against enemy bombers wasn't zapping them down, but targeting them with a radar that could direct anti-aircraft fire. But it didn't shut the door completely. The minister still offered $1,000 to anyone who could demonstrate a death ray that could kill a sheep from 100 yards away. It seems no one could. In all this, Tesla still occasionally talked about death rays, and in 1934 he announced that he invented a death beam that would fire a beam of tiny particles as far as the Earth's curvature allowed. When he died in 1943, the US War Department sent an expert on high voltage engineering from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, John G. Trump, to go through his papers for anything of military interest. The professor found that in 1935, the Soviet Union paid Tesla £25,000 for his plans, but never got the thing to work. Nothing else was of much military value, Trump wrote. Most of Tesla's highly regarded work had been done in the previous century, and his more recent ideas were largely speculative. The professor's nephew, the current US Commander-in-Chief, Donald J. Trump, is famously proud of his big nuclear button. Yet despite billions of dollars spent on energy weapons, the unstoppable death ray remains out of anyone's reach, unless some alien civilization has cracked it. Citizens of the working are okay. Oh, it's a big blue-tongued lizard coming along. Good old chap. So this is a little lizard. Here you go, mate. They're really cute, these lizards. So this lizard, I don't know, it's about 30 centimetres long. Nice quiet lizard. Okay, thanks a lot for listening. I'll get this one off. Sorry, I'm a bit under the weather in reading. I'll just try and improve in the future. Thanks for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.